Senate State Affairs to order on March 6th. It's about 1 minute after the hour. Appreciate you all's promptness. And we're served this morning by my very able committee aide, Joshua Banks. And we got the A-team here. Chris, back recording. And Jess, I suspect it won't be a busy morning for you. It doesn't look like a lot of people being calling in. All right, we have three orders of business. We're going to take them up in this order. Senator Fairclough has a meeting upstairs that she thinks is important, finance, and so we're going to try to get her issue up and let her go back to work there. And then we'll take up the three or four confirmations we have, and then we'll have an introduction at least of Senate Joint Resolution 18. So, Ms. Fairclough. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the State Senate Finance, State Affairs Committee. Thank you very much. My name is Senator Anna Fairclough, representing East Anchorage and Eagle River. Joining me at the table this morning is Kristen Pratt. She will help me, should I need help. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Joint Resolution 23 amends the Constitution, which is a very serious matter. And how it does that is very simplistically. It allows us to authorize a loan for post-secondary students. So it fits into a constitutional amendment in that it's allowable. And what would happen is for a bond to be issued, post-secondary education would have to come to the legislature and ask, and then we would have to go to voters and ask the voters if they agreed with us. So currently state law under our Constitution allows for capital improvement indebtedness and housing loans for veterans. And so this would expand that authority to cover debt for one more entity. With that, that's pretty much it. I'm open to question or let my staff highlight anything that I have failed to let you know.
Anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, I think she covered it.
Ably. Questions from the committee? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll ask the why. Why is this needed?
Oh, and pardon me. We have present Senator Walkowski, Senator Coghill, Senator Giesel, and myself, Dyson.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, thank you so much. Even seasoned senators get nervous in front of committees. So why? Senator Giesel, students across our nation are experiencing a high debt load, something that our forefathers probably never considered. Debt was something different many years ago than it is today. We are borrowing, or our students are borrowing in Alaska at a much higher rate than they can achieve or acquire a loan nationally. The federal national loan program was at 7% and has been reduced to 3.86%. So we would hope that students go and try to access federal loans first. But right now, because of the structure of our loan system, we're financing loan debt for our students somewhere above 7% for this year. 7.30 is what the department provided us for Alaska supplemental education loans and family education loans. So the purpose of this is if it makes sense that we could first extend loans at a lower interest rate by using the full faith and credit and our AAA credit rating for our students to offer that lower loan. And then second, over time, as this process evolves further, that we could actually help students that are out there with those higher interest loans by refinancing those loans and helping them to have less debt.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And thank you for coming to my office and walking me through the bill beforehand. It was very helpful. And I support your efforts. I think we need to drive down the loan costs for students. I think they're outrageously high in Alaska. When banks can get loans for less than 1%, we're charging students 7%. There's just something wrong with our priorities. And so I'm hoping that we can drive down the interest rate through this. Can you talk a little bit about how much you think we can drive them down, and is this a better approach than funding loans through the general fund, let's say?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, through the general fund, I think, would create the lowest debt to the students, but that has been hard to do at times when prices per barrel of oil are down at $9 and budgets get tight. It's much more difficult for us to acquire, on behalf of students, the general fund with deposit over into post-secondary education. I have Diane Behrens on the line. She certainly could speak to that. My understanding is it would be a percent, maybe a percent plus. It just depends on what the market is doing.
Diane, are you online? Can you hear us? She may show up later. If you are there, Diane.
I've been unmuted.
Good. Please identify yourself for the record, and is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation?
Yes. Ms. Chair, this is Diane Behrens for the record. I'm the Executive Officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation and the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Senator Fairclough has done a very excellent job of explaining the objective and the reasons behind this resolution that's before you today. To go to Senator Wilikowski's question, she's absolutely correct. We can, depending on what's occurring in the market, we can expect general obligation bonds with the state's AAA credit behind it to achieve at least a percentage point reduction below what we could otherwise achieve. I would add to that that another benefit would be that with the rating agencies and investors looking at the state's credit rather than scrutinizing the education loans that we're using and that will provide revenue to pay down those bonds, we may be able to widen the credit criteria just a bit so that more of our Alaska students can qualify. So I think that, too, is a very important objective that I'd like to draw attention to.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to expand on that a little bit, if you recall, I think it was right before the 2008 period, as far as the financial crisis goes, and maybe it was right after, Ms. Behrens could give you that detail, but the federal government actually increased the credit scores required to access loans, and we had that decision before this body when I served in the other house. And what that did, in essence, to define it in a very nutshell, is that if you had no credit before, you were considered as good credit, and that people would take a risk on you. But the new definition of that said if you had no credit, you have no credit. And so they established a minimum credit score to achieve good credit, and students weren't getting that. So as an example for me, I had two sons that were getting ready to go to college. One of them I was able to pay, well, we still went for loans, but I paid those loans off with his savings from his permanent funds. The other one, though, is in the system now and is having to pay down those loans. So it's very different. I had to co-sign on his loans. He could not acquire loans even though he had a job and was going to school and paying his own way. They just would not, he didn't have a credit score or loan outs for him to obtain credit. So between his dad and myself, we had to take on debt as a co-signer on our debt. Or on our credit rating.
Senator Wilikowski.
Oh, I was just going to ask, I think whoever's online, about the interest rate. I think the big concern, this is becoming a national crisis. Student loan is just crushing debt. I think there's $1 trillion of outstanding student loan debt. How much do you think this will drop the interest rate down for students? And can you talk about if we're AAA rated, what sort of rate would the state be paying, and then what sort of rate would we be charging the students? And do you think this is the best way to to get the rate the rates down as low as possible, or the most feasible way, I suppose.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is Diane Behrens. I think we can make a significant change to the interest rates. We have to be aware, however, that right now and for the last several years, market-based rates have been at historical lows. So I don't want to overpromise. What using the state's AAA rating will do will allow us to achieve the lowest possible cost of funds. I believe we've looked at that. If we were in the market today with AAA debt, I think we would be in the 4.5 to 4.6 range. So, you know, that's compared to if we were in the market today with student loan-backed bonds, we would be at least a percentage and a half higher than that. So that's kind of the differential that you can achieve. But again, it would allow us as well to make the loans more widely available to students. Right now, as Senator Fairclough points out in her sponsor statement, we deny over 40% of applicants who come to us now. So we're failing to really deliver the kind of program to state residents that we should, both with respect to price and availability. To your second, more broad question regarding is this the best approach, I would suggest it is. Not only will we not be looking at a sort of a year-to-year situation where if we were to go to a general fund supported program where we have to rely on what other priorities the state is dealing with financially and we can't make a long-term commitment to borrowers, but we're using the state's credit very efficiently without associating a financial obligation on the state. The loans themselves can be structured to pay down the bonds, avoid any potential burden on the state general fund, but still deliver a product that would rival any other non-federal loan in the country. We would hopefully be second to none under this structure.
Senator Wilikowski, to continue.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just two other things. Is this essentially revenue neutral? In other words, does the state just pass through the costs and maybe tack on a little bit more for administrative costs, or is the state losing money? Is the state making money if this were to go through? And then delinquency rate, and can you tell us what that is in Alaska, what you project it to be? Do you foresee that as a problem?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, with respect to the cost, it is revenue neutral. The corporation's sort of business model, if you will, over the years has been to keep our cost to the borrower as low as possible while still being in a position to demonstrate good faith, repaying bondholders. We have issued hundreds of millions of dollars of bonds over the years and have never had to look to the state, which actually has a moral obligation in the event the corporation is unable to repay its debt. In statute, we would be able to go to the legislature and ask them to cover whatever shortfall that we might have. We've never been in that position. Over the years, we have been able to, through yearly set borrower benefits, to the extent the corporation has the financial capacity, we give that back to borrowers in the form of credits that are applied to their loans. So I would point out that the interest rate on our loans have been in the 7% range for the last several years, but we have annually provided benefits back to the borrowers that have been as high as, in a given year, as high as almost 3% reduction on their debt. We don't have that capacity currently. The amount of benefit that a borrower can get right now on our loans is a total of 0.75%. That's for a student who attends in Alaska and is making automated payments. So we can drive our rates down a bit, but it is, to your point, it is revenue neutral for all intents and purposes. With respect to delinquency rates, we have seen those be quite low. Or if you look over the last 10, 13 years, we've had rates that have ranged between the 5% default rate up to as high. I think we've been around 8% during the recessionary period. We did see the rates rise somewhat, but in the last 2 years, they've started to decline again. So I think we're in a very good situation from an administrative standpoint to look to kind of this next generation of student loan financing under this geo-supported model. And I hope that answered your question.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you probably gave us all the information we needed and some. Any other questions or comments from the committee? I have online certainly an acquaintance and not a friend of mine, Mike Coons in Palmer. Thanks for calling in, Mike. Identify yourself for the record, and please give us your testimony. And fairly briefly, if you can. We have quite a bit of business this morning.
And I understand that. This is Mike Coons calling from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. I saw this this morning as far as the agenda items, and I looked at the bill. And so I really didn't have any prepared statement on this because I really wanted to hear what the sponsor was going to say. And so I'm just going to kind of give you some thoughts on this real quick. Number one, I am absolutely opposed to this. We are a debtor nation now. We're not a saving nation. I don't care if we bring the interest rate down to 1%. That just actually enables these students to go out and get a loan that they are going to be saddled with for many, 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 many years. It doesn't matter if it's 1% or 7%. Matter of fact, 7% is probably going to give them a little bit more of a, oh, do I really want to do this versus paying as I go. If you listen, Mr. Chairman, you know I'm a big Dave Ramsey fan. I would suggest that the sponsor and the committee take a listen to Dave Ramsey for about 2 weeks before you even come up with a vote on this, and listen to the people that call in that have got Sallie Mae debts of $150,000, $100,000, $200,000. And some of those are actually a career field that they've been going through college that don't pay really good. We've got also mutual fund savings accounts that are out there that've been around for a long time that families can put money away for college for the kids to good solid mutual funds that are bringing in 8%, 10%, 12% interest that they can pay for their college.
Can you summarize, Mike?
The fund, you can put that money in.
Can you summarize, Mike?
This is not something that we need to do. We need to get these kids to out there be saving, families to be saving. If they want to send their kids to college, fine, that's great. We need to encourage that. But we do not need to encourage indebtedness by reducing the interest rate and saying, oh, yeah, we're giving you a better deal. No, all we're doing is making them a slave to their debt, and these kids are never going to see when you talk $150,000 Sallie Mae, that's a home. That's a home in a lot of places in the lower 48. That's the cost of my home at $152,000.
Mike, can you wrap it up, please?
So, please do not pass this out, please.
All right, thanks. Any questions for Mike? Thanks for calling in, Mike. How's the weather at home? He's gone. All right. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? As I understand it, Senator Fairclough, this resolution, it gets on the ballot and the voters approve it, then it would have to come back and be authorized by specific law that you'll work on next year, right?
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond, first if the public hearing is closed?
Yeah, we'll close the public hearing.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess the first question in response would be, should Alaska have a student loan program so that our, if those in need and wanted to go to school, should they be able to acquire debt? So I don't disagree with Mr. Coons at all. I think that we should say that's why our family was actually able to pay off the first son's college debt, because we saved for that. But the second one wanted to go longer, and we didn't have the resources at that time. So I would just ask you to consider first whether we should have a student loan program for those who can't or don't, for whatever reason, have savings or parents that can help them out, couldn't achieve a job. And if you believe that that Alaska is doing the right thing in advancing an opportunity for students to go to school, then I think that you should vote yes for this. And Senator Dyson, specifically to your question, the Student Loan Corporation already has the capacity to borrow, so there's no new nothing new that would have to happen there. I have a different bill that you will see, I hope, on the Senate floor this session, that does make some changes to post-secondary education, but it's not here. I totally agree, again, with the person who testified, that you can carry less debt if you actually are on time in graduation. And so what can the state of Alaska do if we want to help students graduate, to actually help them understand the cost of education and the debt that they will carry in the future? So I do agree, debt is bad. But some people don't have a choice, and I hope I've answered your question.
Any further question, discussion? Senator Coggill.
Just discussion. You know, this is a tool, and it's allowing the state to put together a way to take best use of its money, because it really comes down to the cost of money. But I do agree on both accounts that we don't want to if this becomes a tool to use, we don't want to use it unwisely. And so I think just that cautionary note is wise, but I think having a tool by the state, I think, is a good thing. So I appreciate you looking into this.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I too agree that the gentleman that called in made excellent points, and I agree with the sponsor of the bill that debt is not good. You know, I support this this resolution, but it doesn't really get to the problem. The question is, why is secondary education becoming more and more and more and more expensive? And that is a very long discussion that of course this doesn't address. But I do support the resolution. Thank you.
Well, Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Joint Resolution 23 move from this committee, version 28LS1394/U umbrella, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paper. Take up the appointment of Commissioner of Department of Administration, Curtis Thayer. Please identify yourself for the record and explain to us why you're interested in this interesting job.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I currently serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Administration.
Designee.
Sorry. I guess first off, to understand a little bit about my interest in this position is a little bit about where I came from and how I arrived here today. I was born and raised here in Alaska. I graduated from Bartlett High School in Anchorage and went on to attend the University of Alaska Fairbanks, graduating from there. Then I had a unique opportunity to work for the Federal Bureau of Investigation as a paralegal, and from there I went on to Washington, D.C., and I worked for Congressman Young for what became 7 years, both in Washington, D.C. and in Alaska, and then had opportunities to work with Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Ted Stevens. Upon that, I returned back to Alaska, and I entered into the private sector. I worked with BP, Phillips at the time, and ExxonMobil the last time we were going to really build a gas line, and worked for that for several years and went on to work with InStar Natural Gas as the Director of Corporate and External Affairs. I was responsible for the marketing team, customer service, credit, external affairs, not only for and on federal affairs, not only for the local company, but also our parent company that was headquartered in Michigan. The governor gave me a very unique opportunity and asked if I would join his administration in 2009 as the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And in that role, we at that time, there was one deputy commissioner, and I was responsible for the direct oversight of our banking and securities division, division of insurance, economic development, corporations, business and professional licensing, and also community and regional affairs, and had some administrative oversight of some various corporations. And I also served on the board of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, the Seafood Marketing, and I currently still serve as the board of the Marine, chairman of the Board of Marine Pilots, and have been in that role for just now coming up on 4 years. The governor asked me to take an opportunity that was presented itself in the Department of Administration to serve as Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. So I moved over into that department, and I was responsible for Division of Administrative Services, Division of General Services, Enterprise Technology, our IT for the state of Alaska, along with the Division of Personnel, Labor Relations, and Division of Motor Vehicles. At the same time, when Becky Holtberg went on to move into the private sector back in December, the governor asked if I would consider serving as the commissioner of the Department of Administration. And so that kind of takes me to where I am today. It is something where there's a lot of challenges ahead with the Department of Administration. I can say that Becky Holtberg left the department, I think, in better condition as she found it, and I would hope that would be my imprint on the department also. You know, a little bit about philosophy and the department itself. You know, it's a customer service oriented department. It's a cost center for the state. If there was a state agency that nobody quite knew where to put, Department of Administration, it fit just fine. We have anything, as you know, from our personnel and labor relations to public defenders, public of Office of Public Advocacy, retirement and benefits, DMV, our Division of Motor Vehicles are there, general services. So it is all customer service, whether those customers are our employees, whether they are retirees, or whether they are our constituencies. And that's where I look to see that I think I can strive at. You know, I look at three things when I hire somebody. I want to hire good employees, I want to hire trustworthy employees, and I want there to be loyalty. And with that, I ask nothing of my employees that I would not ask of myself to do. I think the only exception is I don't clear out the copy machine when it becomes jammed. I'm not good at that part. But with that I think takes me to where I am today.
Sitting in front of this intimidating committee.
Any questions for Curtis?
Senator Murkowski.
Thank you. Good to see you, Curtis. Thank you for your service. Couple things. My office has been trying to get a side-by-side on the retiree health care changes, and could you just look into that and see that we got a copy of that? I've got some retirees in my district who have been trying to get that.
Through the chair, Senator Murkowski, we are working on that. We talked about it last night. Just a little bit on that is the department, when we moved to Aetna, I think we were under the impression we were doing a good thing by taking the existing plan book and including everything that had was in all the addendums over the years. But that's become a confusion. And so we are working on that side by side, and we've extended the comment period for retirees 60 days. And so it's a reasonable request, and we're working on that.
Thank you. And then if I could, one or two more questions, Mr. Chair. And I've gotten emails from PERS, TERS, retirees. I've gotten them over the years. I've gotten a few more, seemingly more desperate this year. Hey, is my pension safe? Are my retirement benefits safe? And I said, I'm glad you asked. I've got the commissioner in front of me. And so, what are your thoughts on whether or not you believe retiree benefits can be diminished over time? There are many of us who believe the Constitution says that can't be. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that. And then whether or not you feel that retirees' benefits, pensions, health care are safe going on into the future.
Through the chair, Senator Wilankowski, I do not believe the benefits of retirees can be diminished, whether that be their pension or whether that be their health care. And on the same note, I know that the unfunded liability that the state carries, which is currently a little shy of $12 billion, is something that I think we all struggle with, legislature and the governor. The governor has a proposal of looking at moving $3 billion into the PERS and TERS liability to try to write that and get the investment earnings so it goes out into the future and we can cap at $500 million the state obligation. And so we're working with the legislature, the administration is, on that, because I do think that we do have an ongoing issue and we have the financial means in which to do it. And I personally would rather see us take a bite at that apple now to start to resolve the problem than kick the can down the road.
Thank you. And I appreciate those efforts. I support you and the administration's efforts to pay down the debt, $3 billion. I support those efforts. And just one other question on recruitment and retention. It's been a subject of this committee for many years, of the legislature for many years. Many of us believe we should have a defined benefit system for employees. I know there's an effort on the House side to return that for public employee, police officers, or not just police officers, public safety officers. Can you talk about recruitment and retention, whether or not you think we're doing what we need to do to keep people with the state, good, bright people here working for the state, working for teaching, firefighting, police officers, et cetera, and do you think there need to be changes, or is the system fine the way it is?
Through the chair, that's several different points of view on that. First off, I'm a Tier 4 employee, as is close to 45% of our current workforce is today. But I came out of the private sector, so I'm familiar with what Tier 4 is in a 401k system. And my wife is in the banking industry. She has a 401k. So I'm saying for me personally, I see the benefits of that for me at my age. But clearly, as the state moves forward with retention of state employees, one of the things that we do have is for our classified employees, we have a very robust retention and payroll for those employees. We are the only state in the union that did not freeze pay salaries. Matter of fact, they increased since 2008. We're not seeing necessarily an issue with retention of our employees. One thing that I know with police and fire, we've been looking at that bill. The administration doesn't have a position on that bill at this time, but it is something where I have actually met with, I believe it was Westcott, I can't think of his title, I think he's a deputy fire chief. And so we're sitting and having those discussions, but I think it's a little premature until the bill advances to see, a concern that I would have, and that with a bill such as that is, if you narrow it to police and fire, which is great, which is a great thing to do to narrow it, but it's something that could be easily expanded. And then does it put us right back into our situation with our PERS and TERS liability if we get more people into the system? So I think those are things that just through the legislative process we need to work at and look at to see as the bill advances and get some of those concerns on record. And maybe there's workarounds to them. But it's really easy to say we're going to define these two groups of people and put them in a defined benefit plan, and then you sit over here and have 45% of the workforce is in a defined contribution plan that seems to be that is working, and where we find that medium. And that's a call for the legislature to make.
Just one last thing, Mr. Chair, and it's not a question, it's just a comment, but I appreciate you looking into that. And you and I talked a month and a half ago at the governor's house for an event, and I think there's a win-win there. I think the state can set up a Taft-Hartley-like plan for its employees where they can make a contribution and then be off the hook. And what employees want, the concern that employees have is when they retire, they don't know if they're going to live for 30 days or 30 years. And so they have to invest very conservatively, whereas when you have a pool of people you can invest and get much bigger returns, you have professional investors. And so there are tremendous advantages for in that type of system. And you can develop a system where the state makes a contribution and you're off the hook. And I think that's what that bill attempts to do. I think it's a win-win solution. So I would just encourage you to look in that direction for all public employees, quite frankly.
There, a constituent emailed me a question that he would like to ask of you. I'm supposed to ask you, are you aware that employees of DNR's fire and aviation program are classified as clerical workers, and would you support reclassifying them more appropriately to first responders?
Mr. Chair, I am aware of the issue. It has come up, and we have, matter of fact, it's something Retirement Benefits is looking at, is because a lot of it, and this is probably more into the minutiae of the details, is what exactly their job functions are and where are they in return as far as being actually on the front line, being a first responder, or being back at headquarters and the fire's 200 miles away, and that classification of a first responder. So it is something we're looking at. It is a concern that we're aware of.
Yeah, this gentleman has been a fire chief and had a lot of credibility with me. He says these people are amongst the very best trained brush fire, wildland fire people in the state. Anyways, I appreciate your efforts, and I will report to him. I'm just thinking about the efficacy of here, while your confirmation is pending, we're asking you all these tough questions.
Mr. Chair, those questions come every day.
Is there objection to moving this appointment forward? All right. In accordance with Article 3, Section 25 of the Alaska Constitution, Alaska Statute 3905080, State of Care Committee reviewed the following and recommends an appointment forward to the joint session for consideration. Commissioner of Department of Administration, Curtis Thayer. This does not reflect the intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during further session. All right. So we'll take a brief at ease. We have passed the Christensen, Commission for Human Rights, Nora Barlow, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and Richard Burton, Alaska Police Standards Council. I'm going to take these in the order that they were signed up. So this is first one's Emmanuel Lewis, State Commission on Human Rights. Can you hear us, Emmanuel?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear. Please give us something of your background and tell us why you want to serve in this capacity.
Hey, well, everyone, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I've been a resident for about 3 years. Ever since I've been in Alaska, I've been involved both in different businesses as well as nonprofits, helping people that are at risk, both youth and adults. If you look at my resume, you'll see that I've moved around the country a lot. I grew up in Georgia. Being a young African American in Georgia, I definitely see what discrimination is and how it can affect a person's life. But after living in Georgia, I went to college and I've learned a lot from the different organizations and businesses that I've worked for. What you'll get from me being on the Human Rights Commission is a well-balanced view into the needs of both residents when it comes to being to not being discriminated against, and businesses that need to, you know, provide for themselves, which also provides for the residents and state in general. So that's about it, really. Sorry, I was a little flustered. Someone walked into my office, even though the door is closed. So I was freaking out a little bit. But yeah, I would love to take any questions you guys have.
Any questions or comments about Emmanuel Lewis's seeking this position? Senator Wilkowski.
So you said you've lived here for 3 years?
Yes, sir.
Do you feel like you have enough knowledge about the state to be able to effectively sit on this commission?
I do. My first position here was a government account manager with AT&T, the telecom company. And what that position allowed me to do was travel around the state and work with state and local government, as well as nonprofit organizations, school districts, and regional hospitals. So I've traveled most of the state, both in Southeast Alaska, Western Alaska, and up to Fairbanks and Barrow and all those great places. And I've learned about different communities in each area and the needs of those communities and the people that live in those communities. So I've seen both the businesses, such as the fisheries down in Wrangell and Petersburg, as well as the people that live there and the things that they care about. So I believe that my knowledge of the state actually goes beyond some people that have lived here a little longer than me, just by the amount of travel and partnership that I've done with the various communities.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And just looking at the Alaska State Commission of Human Rights and the things that are covered, there's race, color, religion, sex, national origin, physical and mental disability. There's a bill moving through the body right now to expand that to prohibit discrimination against sexual orientation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think that's needed, to be completely honest. I do think that's needed. I think that's the way that the rest of the country is moving, and I think it's fair to put that into place.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any further questions or comments? All right, we'll move on then to Michelle Christensen. Can you hear us, Michelle? Michelle? All right. We'll go
Good morning.
So Michelle, please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. It's an honor to be nominated by the governor, and I thank you for your time today. I wanted to give you a little bit of background, explaining my history will explain, I think, or give basis of why I think I'd be a good fit for the commission. I was born and raised in Alaska, although I'm not Alaska Native. I'm native to Alaska. I'm a proud mother of two successful Alaska Native adult children. I currently work part-time for MTNT, IT and Communications as contract compliance support, and then part-time as a compliance consultant for Crystal Clear Compliance. Previous to that, I worked at Coconut Region, Inc., and I was responsible for overseeing their corporate compliance and ethics program and assisting their corporate subsidiaries. Prior to joining CERI, I was the office manager for Alaska Native Justice Center, where I advocated on behalf of Alaska Natives due to the inequities in the justice, the criminal and justice system. I also promoted and presented remote youth court models to remote villages and organized agencies and public meetings on issues affecting Alaska Natives. I began my career as a deputy clerk for the Alaska court system and then later worked as a paralegal for Boyko and Flansburger and Hopper and Holt prior to serving as a legal secretary for Max Gruenberg. I'm a certified compliance and ethics professional, one of the first that was certified in the United States. Prior to that, I earned my bachelor's degree at Alaska Pacific University and my paralegal certificate from the University of Alaska. I'm currently a member of the Society of Ethics and Compliance and chair of the SCC Alaska Regional Conference. I've also served on the Anchorage Native Concerns Committee, served as a member of the Anchorage United for Youth, where I chair their family support and engagement group. And there we worked with a diverse group of people in Mountain View, along with the Boys and Girls Club, and had service providers come out and work with a diverse group of people who needed services. They couldn't necessarily get to the services, so we attempted to provide the services to them. And although it didn't necessarily work out, unfortunately, the resources were tapped, and they didn't have the time, and we didn't have the community, enough community members needing services that we eventually disbanded that project. Thereafter, I also served as the Anchorage United for Youth Alaska Civil United for Youth Leadership Committee meeting.
Michelle?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you have an impressive resume, and it's got a lot of detail in it, and I think most of us have read it already. I'd like to have a little bit of time here for committee members to ask you questions.
Okay.
Is there anything more important that you feel you need to say?
No, I think that, like I said, with my history, I think that gives you a, well, I think it supports my strong belief in equality. I guess that's what I was getting to.
All right. Any questions, the committee? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michelle, I'm looking at your application for boards and commissions, and it is an impressive resume, and I certainly see your comprehensive view of Alaskans in it. One thing I'm intrigued with is the application was actually for the Bar Association, and then the three additional boards you cited was the Alcohol Beverage Control, Regulatory Commission, and Workers' Compensation Board. Those four are very different than the Commission on Human Rights. How do you feel about that?
I can speak to that. Initially, I think it was last year I applied for the Alaska Bar, and then since changing jobs and actually learning more about the Human Rights Commission through some research and other things. When I met with the boards and commissions, they explained that that was also open, and so I went and reapplied.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions or comments? Michelle, I served on the Human Rights Commission for 3 years, and buckle up, it's a wild, pretty wild ride, and I suspect that
Are you warning me? No, I've dealt with a lot of issues, especially through the Alaska Native Justice Center, and then just with the diversified population, like I said, in Mountain View area. And I really do think there is some inequities out there, and I think it's important. It's an important mission, and it's an important thing.
You're right
for
about
our community.
That.
So. I appreciate the heads up, but I'm hoping that I'll find this beneficial, and the community will benefit from that also.
Yeah, you will, and the community is well served by the function. I'm sure it'll be shocking to you, but you'll sometimes find there's at least two sides to the cases that are presented before you. And not everybody, not everybody that appears before you, like here, is tells the whole truth without a spin on it. Is there objection to moving this nomination forward? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle, for your past and future service.
Thank you. And thank you for serving our great state, each of you. Have a great day.
Thank you. We'll go now to Nora Barlow, Violent Crimes Compensation Board. I think you're in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Nora?
Yes, I can.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony or remarks.
Yeah, my name is Nora Barlow, and I'm actually a current member of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. I was appointed originally when Leroy Barker, their former attorney member, retired, and I served 1 year out of the, or the remaining 1 year. I then was appointed and confirmed again, and so this would be my second time, or my third time, becoming before you, asking to be appointed to the board again. I enjoy my work. I think it's important. I've gotten to come down and meet all of you every year and keep you up to date on what's going on with the board and what we're doing, and I would just ask that I be reconfirmed again.
Questions? Comments? Senator Wilkowski?
Comment. Nora, it's good to hear you. I've always appreciated your visits and the great work you're doing on the commission, or on the board, rather. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Nora, you probably know we've got a couple pieces of legislation going around that should significantly equip you guys to do a lot more of the mission that you wanted to do.
And Thank you, Senator Dyson. I was aware of that, and we truly appreciate your efforts.
Yeah, well, you and Jared are almost an irresistible force.
Well, I'll remember that next time we come down and ask for something.
Yeah, when they show up, I just turn around, back up with my arm up between my shoulder blades. I think we have left Richard Burton for Alaska Peace Standards Council. Can you hear us, Richard? I think you're in Ketchikan.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record, and good to hear from you. And I'm amazed that you want to continue serving, but please give us your remarks or testimony.
Yes, sir. My name is Richard Burton. Some of you remember me from a few years past, and some of you I remember, I'm sure. Maybe we get some of you forget that. But anyway, I'm retired Commissioner of Public Safety, retired in 1995 when Governor Hickel was there. I also was Commissioner of Public Safety under Jay Hammond, which was about 2 years ago when we created the Alaska Police Standards legislation. Some of you may remember Pat Wellington, but he and I worked together on that when we were younger and getting the bill crafted, drafted, and passed. And thanks to our late Senator Bill Ray, it came out as Senate Bill Number 1 the first year without going through two years of legislation, which I know you can appreciate how good we felt about that. But to keep it brief, you've been provided with my resume, which is sometimes I read it and I wonder if I really was talking about that me in there, that it's been a long one. I've been in Alaska, first came here in 1952, got into law enforcement early, one of the first hires with the statehood for new troopers. Worked in the bush, worked in Fairbanks, worked just about every place. But during those early years, one of the things that affected me most of all is why I was so serious about police standards is when I first went to work on a police department, there was no minimum standards, there was no training, there was... That's my first shift that I spent with another guy who was hired the same day. We had to buy our own uniforms and go to work. Didn't know anything about the law, didn't know anything about anything else. And I won't give you the details about what we did then with the liability that was probably the city could have been had because of the way we handled the drunk driver by giving him his license and telling him to drive home. So we won't go into that long story. But that's been something that stayed with me forever. And the need to get professional police officers, public safety officers, in the state. And I've been on the council for a number of years. I haven't counted them, but automatically I was there 2 terms that I was commissioner. I'm on it presently, and right now one of the reasons I would like to get another term is we're in the middle. I'm on a subcommittee. We're reviewing the regulations and the statutes that haven't been looked at in years, since, and things change and times change, and so we're trying to bring all of this into today's world, and we're still working on it, and I'd like to be around to help finish that in the next year or so. Outside of that, I have a different perspective of things because of having worked overseas. I've worked in Micronesia. I've worked on Indian reservations. And since I retired, that's the kind of jobs that I've had. I'm also a and gets called. I haven't been lately because things have been good, but I usually get called when there's a breakdown somewhere in a police department, and I get called by the management or the administration to come in and work with those kind of things. So I'm familiar with the fact that conduct and good conduct and good quality people have on law enforcement. In the last few years, unfortunately, we've all noticed in the public that as good as it is, as hard as we try, there's some pretty bizarre behavior done by people who should not have probably have been hired in the first place. But all of that, I'll just say that's it, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to ask you a question that I got a little bit fuzzy on when we were discussing this very council a few days ago. So as I understood the answers I got back, that you all are not bound to just deal with incidents where a case is brought before you, but indeed you can respond and investigate when there's been even an anonymous whistleblower. Is that your understanding?
Yes, we do, and we have. I think there's some cases I couldn't cite off the top of my head, but yes, most people need to know that they can't do that. And we're not a appeals court by any means, but it's where they're not getting any action is one thing. But if they've gone to court, they've gone and they don't like the, some people kind of come and say, well, we don't like that decision. Well, you know, we're not an appeals court at all.
Yeah, no, I understand that you said yes. The other question that I had, and it certainly happened to me when I was supervising a lot of people, I was told that I could not, if somebody inquired who was thinking about hiring somebody that had worked for me, I was told I couldn't tell them anything except their dates of employment. And I have a situation where a kid in my neighborhood knew his family. He went to work for 3 different police departments in the States, got ran off on the first 2, but he kind of bargained his way out of it. He said, I'll resign if you guys have nothing on my record. So then he went on to be police chief at 2 other small communities with similar unsatisfactory results. So you probably know my friend Chuck Kopp.
Yes, I know him very well.
Yeah, and he thinks very highly of you. So Chuck and I were talking about that last night, and what I'm fuzzy about, can a police department that is interviewing say to the potential employee, will you give us a release so that we can get your information from your previous employer?
Yes, sir. My memory serves me right, but our director could answer that for you more. In fact, I think that's part of the paperwork. I haven't looked at the actual forms that we've developed over the years. That's one of the things that this committee has. If they lie on their applications, that's because it's under oath. They're guilty of perjury.
Yeah.
And that's the forms that come from the police department. And if we have to investigate cases, we also have the council has the power of subpoena, even to investigate cases. So So it doesn't have to be something that we just wait for a sort of police chief to just send us something that says, we fired this person, this is the reason why. And we look at it, does it meet the standards to decertify or not decertify, and that sort of thing. So it doesn't have to wait for that. We're not
right,
just waiting.
I got it. I got
we
it.
We are the what has power.
Yeah, and I'm pleased that you're taking this job because I know you have the courage and integrity to go after weeding out the bad guys. I used to be able to say with great pride that in Alaska we've had no dirty cops or corrections officers, no unnecessary violence, and no unethical behavior, in particular sexual exploitation. Sadly, I can't say that with as much authority as I used to, but people like you serving, and you're pretty streetwise, I think you'll be a real asset, and thank you. Is there any objection to moving this all these recommendations forward? All right. Seeing none, we'll advance them to the commission process. Let's see. Yeah. In accordance with AS 3905080, the State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommend appointments to be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. State Commission of Human Rights, Michelle Christensen, Emmanuel Lewis, Alaska Police Standards Council, Richard Burton, and Violent Crimes Compensation Board, Nancy Barlow. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of these individuals during further sessions. All right. We'll go off the record here for a minute. On the record, we're going to take up Senate Joint Resolution 18. We have quite a few people who would like to talk to us. It is not my intention to move this bill, this resolution today. There's quite a bit of backup material in your packet, and I'm hoping that we'll get at least a brief explanation from my staff, Tyler Belt, and I might add delightful staff, the intern, and then there's a man, Robert Kelly, in Purcellville, Virginia, who's working on this project on a national level. I see that there are four high school students from Healy, Tri-Valley High School. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
All right.
Yes, we can.
All right. Is this a part of a class project?
A few of us were asked if we were interested in it, and we wrote testimonies.
All right. And we're going to be a little pressed for time. We will take this up again next week, and that'll be noticed. I'd really encourage you to get your written testimony in, and I'm not at all intending to be disrespectful, but we got quite a bit to cover here. So we'll see how far we get, and maybe you can work together a little bit there and summarize your testimony that overlaps in the interest of time. But I'm glad you've taken an interest, and we want to hear from you all. All right, Tyler.
Good morning. Tyler Bell. For the record, staff to Senator Dyson. So, as I presented last week, we have quite the monumental resolution in front of us. from a lens greater than ourselves, I mean, we're talking about looking at one of the great documents in human history, the United States Constitution. And a convention of the states is a means to operate and examine the document and amend the document without putting the entirety and the integrity of the thing at risk. So in general, it's a great opportunity to operate without ramification, if you will. It's a great opportunity in general. And so from there, the possibilities are endless. I mean, as people have testified with the last time, this is completely nonpartisan. It's a topic-based convention, and so the will of the time will determine what is covered and who covers it, who talks about it, things along that line. And so from there, it's very easy to see where this could be important on both sides of the political spectrum and from all views and perspectives. And from there, there's no doubt in my mind and most anyone's mind that researches this topic that this will be a monumental occasion in United States history. We're talking about looking at something that essentially binds us as Americans.
Right, and I may add, I think all of us have seen during our years here that it's often very difficult for change, in particular, to come from within any bureaucracy, and often it takes some outside action to overcome the institutional inertia. And it appears to me that the founders, recognizing that, wanted to have a way for the citizens to initiate and affect the possibility of change to the Constitution. I also understand that this is just a first step to get our state in the queue of states that are considering calling for a constitutional convention, and there'll be several steps, agreeing on the rules, on a selection of delegates, the discipline of delegates, the limit of topics, agreement on a topic, and then the convention has to be ratified 2/3, I think, of the states, but you know, before it can even go on a ballot. Very complicated process. I suspect Mr. Kelly will be able to correct any errors in what I've said. My brief exposure is that the folks that are working on this have been very careful about it, and most of the objections have been dealt with, it seemed to me, in a credible way. Now, Mr. Kelly, can you hear us, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, thank you for helping us. I'd like you to be as concise as you can, but we really need the benefit of your experience. So identify yourself for the record, and please give us your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Robert Kelly. I'm the staff counsel at the Convention of States Project, and I will try and keep my remarks as brief as I can.
Now, Mr. Kelly, in my brief exposure to this over the last year, there's three or four groups around the nation that are kind of working somewhat in parallel on all of this kind of an approach. Would you speak briefly to that and then make it clear to us which one of those groups you're working with?
Sure. So the organization I'm working with is Citizens for Self-Governance. That organization has sponsored the Convention of States Project. And what we're arguing for and what we're advocating is a Article 5 convention that specifies a particular set of topics for the convention to cover. So there's really three different approaches from a legislative standpoint on how an Article 5 convention can be run. Basically, a convention could be run as an unlimited convention. That would effectively allow the convention to consider any sort of issue it determined was in the best interest of the American people. Now, we think that's probably not the best approach just because we think the convention first needs guidance and second needs to have limitations put on it to ensure that it stays within proper constitutional boundaries. A second way the application could be phrased, could be worded, is to set out a specific topic or set of topics. This gives the convention some discretion to consider exactly how to propose solutions and how to word amendments. but it also keeps it closely within certain boundaries. And that's the approach our organization is taking. And then there's a third approach, which is to haul the convention to propose specific amendments, to already lay out in advance the amendments that the convention can propose. So that really limits the discretion of the convention. Again, as I said, our approach in SJR 18 are in that middle realm. It sets out a set of topics that the convention has to adhere to, but it allows the convention some discretion to propose a number of amendments within those topics. So the topics in SJR 18 are, first, to place fiscal restraints on the federal government, second, to limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and third, to impose term limits on federal officials and members of Congress. And the reason we think this approach is probably the best approach is because it gives the convention the ability to address the problem of federal overreach as a whole. It can propose essentially a holistic solution to the massive imbalance of power in our federal government. And a single isolated amendment, a convention that's limited to a single amendment, can't do that. So, for instance, we like the idea of a balanced budget amendment, but passing one in the current political climate in Washington, D.C., is likely just going to result in a massive tax hike. So we think a better approach is to allow the convention to consider the problem as a whole, to consider it as a topic, and to allow the convention to formulate exactly what amendments will address that problem, in this case, federal overreach. So, and I will also just mention that that's the approach the founders used for the vast majority of the 32 conventions that they held in the years leading up to the adoption of the Constitution.
Any questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've done just a little bit of research on this, and I've seen some commentary from some law professors that there's some question as to whether or not if there were a constitutional convention that you could actually limit it to the items in the resolution. In other words, once you got there, anything would be open. And since do you have any legal precedent that would address that, or I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
So the Senator, the Supreme Court has never had an opportunity to address this particular legal question of an Article 5 convention. However, what we do have is an extensive set of historical practice, both by the founders and by Americans since the founding. So the founders themselves held at least 32 conventions themselves in the 100 years leading up to the adoption of the Constitution. So if you break that down, that means they were holding a convention just about once every 3 years. We have records of at least 4 conventions since the founding. So in every single one of these conventions, well, I shouldn't say every single one, in the vast majority of these conventions, the founders and the individuals who have since come, for instance, the Washington Peace Conference in 1861, in each of these conventions, there's been set out a specific topic for the convention to consider. So that was the backdrop against which the founders were adding this provision to the Constitution. They limited their conventions to specific topics. Their convention stayed within those boundaries. So it seems to be very clear from the historical record that an Article 5 convention could also be limited within specific topics.
Yeah, Mr. Wilkowski, Senator, I want to get these high school kids.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. I'll hold off, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Kelly, we're probably going to carry this over and vote on it next week. Could you be available?
I would be happy to be available, Mr. Chair.
All right, and sorry for the inconvenience. We've gotten a bit jammed up, but you're a very valuable resource. So hang on. I'm going to go now to the high school students, Tri-Valley and Healy. Can you hear me, students?
Yes, I can.
All right.
I can hear you,
please give us your testimony somewhat succinctly in any order that you choose and identify yourself for the record with your name, please.
Hi, my name is Sabrina Bufflin. I'm a junior at Tri-Valley School, and I would first like to respectfully disagree with your decision to have a high school testimony summarized. Just please think about the message you just sent to us and every other teenager listening to this hearing. We're equally as concerned with this issue. And now, as a student of the U.S. Constitution and our founding principles, I see a problem with our federal government that I want to help fix. The federal government has taken too much power. The convention being discussed today will swing much-needed focus on checking the federal government overreach and returning the reserve power to you, the state. I've already testified on a similar resolution in the House, and in hearing the discussion by members of the House, I feel there is some misled opposition. This resolution should not be difficult. I'm calling for the education of Alaskans. Senators, we need to dust off our constitutions, and we need to ask our founders to answer the constitutional questions, not so-called constitutional attorneys paid by special interest groups and factions. So how do we ask our founders these constitutional questions? In my constitutional government class, we answered all these constitutional questions using our founders' own words written in the Federalist Papers. I challenge you to do the same. The overwhelming power of the federal government is present in all aspects of our everyday life. This is not okay. Regulatory agencies with their agency laws and policies are smothering us here in Alaska. We are warned by history and our founding fathers about national governments gaining too much power. Thomas Jefferson warned us, when governments fear the people, there is liberty. When people fear the government, there is tyranny. How many of you, senators, would fear a visit from the IRS or EPA? America is on the road to a tyranny. I encourage you, senators, to take back state power. This is important to not only each and every Alaskan, but the future of each and every U.S. citizen. Alaskans can lead this charge if we work together, not as divided Republicans and Democrats, but as educated Alaskans. From Federalist Papers...
Can you summarize, Sabrina? Can you summarize?
Just fellow Alaskans, let's work to get Alaskan's sovereign body back and fight to allow a convention of the states. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Who'd like to be next? May not need to repeat what Sabrina said, but who'd like to be next?
Madison Owen.
Oh, please. Go ahead, Madison. Identify yourself.
Right. Hello, my name is Madison Owen. I am a student of Tri-Valley School. Senators, take off your Republican and Democrat party hats and listen up. The Convention of States is not a partisan issue. It is an issue of the current state of the federal government. This issue is a loss of our great experiment. It is the loss of our constitutional republic. It is the turn of the illusional comfort of a democracy. It is the return to exactly what history tells us will eventually fail. Our founding fathers understood the imperfections that make us human and how those imperfections need to be suppressed. When asked about the great experiment, Benjamin Franklin said, "It is a republic if you can keep it." Senators, you must not place your faith and trust in your party label. You must place it in the Constitution. The Constitution was written by men who grew up in a time when reading and educating oneself was a primary form of entertainment. Our founders, the ones who called for a Constitution convention, were highly educated. They studied great philosophers, understood human nature and history. Senators, do not be hesitant to read what was written 250 years ago. I challenge you to read Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Montesquieu, and the Papers because it will give you a greater understanding of what the founders intended for us. You are either for this great experiment or you're against it. That's it. Just two choices. You can return to what our founders originally intended through a convention of states, or you should be calling for a full-out constitutional convention to just throw out what we still have left of our constitutional republic and implement a European-style government. A government that feels good, one that is benevolent, one that meets the wants of every citizen, a warm and fuzzy government. One that history tells us will fall to a slow but assured death. Once again, this is not a partisan issue. Stop all the posturing and listen to each other. More importantly, listen to the founders. Take up the banner of educating yourselves and then lead the charge in educating Americans. I challenge you, senators, take the constitutional final exam that I just recently took. We all need a wake-up call. We all need to stop pretending that we are doing as our founders wished. We need to heed their warnings and pay attention to their wisdom. The choice is yours. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Whoever your teacher is, tell him it's apparently he's done very well. And
all right, I will. Thank you.
And I'm not sure any of us could pass the test you're passing. Isabel, are you there? Isabella?
Yes, I'm here.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Hello, my name is Isabella Sachs, and I'm testifying here from Tri-Valley School in Healy, and I'm calling that I feel that it's obvious that the government has overstepped its bounds and a convention of states is greatly needed. First off, I feel many Americans aren't fully aware that there are two ways to amend the Constitution, most likely due to the fact that of all 27 amendments, every one has taken the first process and been proposed by two-thirds of Congress. But there is another process, attempted in the past but without success. In this process, amendments are proposed by a convention of states and called at the request of two-thirds of the state legislatures. Notice that neither of these processes allow for a constitutional convention, which begins to address the primary opposition to this method, the fear of a runaway convention. And I would like to explain and hopefully dispel this fear, because there are so many checks already put in place to prevent this from happening. Our country has been built on the principle that mankind is imperfect and we need checks and balances, and conventions of states are no exception to these checks. When we call for this convention, we are asking for it to be called with a limited scope of topics and issues we are to discuss only after Congress receives 34 similar applications. Congress will then specify the scope, ensuring that we don't stray from the issues we had planned, to also make sure that we don't come out with an amendment even remotely unrelated to what was proposed. And if that were in some way to happen in spite of the previous checks, where out of this convention came an unrelated amendment, there's another check for that. It is Congress's mandatory duty to deny ratification. You have the authority to keep the convention in check by limiting the amendments that our delegates can discuss. If they happen to go beyond their scope, they can be recalled. These conventions cannot make up their own rules or change existing ones to make ratification an easier process. That's not the way the system is set up. For a long time, power has been slowly relocating out of the states to the federal government, a problem that the founders knew we would encounter eventually. Hence the inclusion of Article 5 in our Constitution. We're not trying to rewrite the Constitution, just take a closer look at it and use it as it was intended. The founders clearly laid out what to do in times like these, and we're ignoring our duty as Americans when we ignore Article 5 and the very directions we have a responsibility to carry out. Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers, "If the federal government should overpass the just bounds of its authority and make a tyrannical use of its powers, the people, whose creature it is, must appeal to the standard they have formed and take such measure to redress the injury done to the Constitution as the exigency may suggest and prudence justify." This was said in 1788 and is very relevant to our government today. When the government has plainly overstepped its boundaries and burdened us with tremendous debt, we have the obligation to act. And speaking for the generation that will grow up in this country, we don't want to grow up amongst piles and piles of debt. Again, I'm a student of a government class in Healy, Alaska, and thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. Nicole McMaster, can you hear us, Nicole?
Yes, I can hear you.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Nicole McMaster. I'm a junior at Tri-Valley School. I would like to express my concern about the federal spending crisis and express my support for the Article 5 Convention of States. This convention has the potential to free my generation from the federal overreach and ever-growing enormous debt. I cannot undertake to lay my finger on that article of the Constitution which granted a right to Congress of expending on objects of benevolence the money of their constituents. These are the words of James Madison, a founding father who attended and took notes of every session of the Constitutional Convention. Madison was concerned that the General Welfare Clause would be abused as the authority to spend on unauthorized objects. I am concerned, too. Over the past 100 years, the federal government has falsely assumed the role of taking care of us by spending our money. History tells us this is a common path. However, history also warns us this is the wrong path. Our founders understood this and came up with a great answer, our Constitution, a new form of government that contained deterrents and roadblocks to this path. They believed it is the state and local community's responsibility to decide how to care for their citizens in areas of welfare, healthcare, and education. The United States has incurred a debt of more than $17 trillion, far exceeding the total value of the annual economic wealth created by the American people. This debt is expected to reach about $26 trillion in a decade. Like the laws of gravity, there is no escaping the laws of economics. Senators, we are headed in a downward direction fast. Congress cannot continue to act as if there is an unlimited source of income for their political whims. Our trillion-dollar debt will not simply disappear. It will become my generation's crisis and the downfall of our great nation. I am not yet an adult, but I already owe the government as much money as it took to raise me. This is exactly what our founding fathers insistently tried to prevent. Thomas Jefferson warned us, We must not let load us with perpetual debt. I am testifying to stop this unconstitutional spending. My fellow Alaskans, senators, please support Article 5, Convention of States. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well done to all of you. The young man who presenting this bill here is an intern that works for me. Another young man who was testifying, presenting in the Judiciary Committee earlier this week was also an intern. So if any of the four of you are looking for jobs or interested in being a service in a relatively key spot, you probably ought to pursue it with your local representative, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies, I just want to thank you for your testimony. I represent a community named the Kiski down on the Kenai Peninsula, and you obviously share the same coursework that those students are also being exposed to. I appreciate your obvious knowledge of our American history and your critical thinking skills. I know many homeschool students who also have been exposed to this kind of factual information and also have cultivated those critical thinking skills. Thank you. You give me hope for the next generation.
Me too. We've got a few minutes left here. We're going to go to David Eichler in North Pole. Can you hear us, David?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry that we're jammed up here for time, but please give us your testimony, and particularly critique anything that we have said here that's errant or that we missed.
Mr. Chairman, I've got about 4 minutes. I really don't have much critique for what's gone before me. I am a volunteer state leader for Convention of States and have promoted both resolutions in the House and the Senate and worked tirelessly to recruit volunteers to support your work and your efforts, both for the resolutions and in the future when we do get an amendment back from the convention to get it properly considered and support the efforts to pass some limitations on the federal government, and I'll limit my testimony to that. Thank you.
And thank you. This is going to be a long fight. My guess is be 3 years plus before it even think about it happening, and more likely five. So probably not going to be, certainly not in my public career, maybe not even my lifetime, but I hope you and the other volunteers are very committed and realizing it's a long-term battle. And from an old war horse, don't get discouraged and quit. We were a long time getting this country bolted together, and it's been quite a fight to keep it. It is unique, and it's worth fighting for. But we need guys like you to hang in there. Any other questions or comments from the committee this time? Senator Cargill.
Just, I think the case made by the students was not only articulate, but it actually emphasized the need to keep pressure under this particular effort to press Congress to have the discussion on a convention dealing with the national debt. It's a stark conversation that before they get out of high school, they already owe not only their generation, but into the next generation for a debt that we have left them. So I greatly appreciate those students who called in, but I think they're probably going to be pretty representative of what people find that they have been saddled with before they even realize it. And so I think this will keep that conversation up, and hopefully Congress will get the idea, even as they hear us deliberating at the state house levels all across the United States. I'm hoping that they get the message even before we get this resolution to them.
All right. Seeing none, we will we'll reconvene on Tuesday, and we're adjourned for today. Thank you all.